Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
And Nathan and Joe are live all this week from the Ryder Cup at the aforementioned Le Golf National. Nathan's standing by. Nathan, I understand you've got some golf writing royalty alongside you there.
Thanks a lot, Richie. Welcome back to Le Golf National. We're situated here in this monstrous media centre where there are many hundreds of golf journalists, but we're very fortunate because we've been joined by one of the greats, Tim Ross, supportive Golf Channel. How are you keeping?
Nathan, you shouldn't throw that one of the greats things right away. I mean, come on. Hey, it's great to be here with you. Love Ireland. I know how people are passionate for golf there, and it's wonderful to have a Ryder Cup here in France. But it's going to be great having an Open Championship next year in your neck of the world, in Northern Ireland.
We're just around 72 hours away from this event, the Ryder Cup, the 42nd Ryder Cup. And it's been a quiet couple of days in that nobody's misspoken. I don't think there have been any real missteps. There's been no great controversy. And maybe, in fact, it's just that everyone's still in the afterglow of what happened in Atlanta on Sunday night and Tiger Woods winning the Tour Championship. We can now definitively say Tiger is back.
Yes, we can. Not surprised, though. It turned back time, but it also seemed like it was about time, in a sense that he'd put himself in position enough to win. And as you know, covering golf, some things just have to happen on the big board for you to, no matter what you shoot, for you to end up with a W. And he played well enough at the PGA. Brooks Koepka outplayed him. He plays well enough at the Open Championship to a certain point in the back nine, and then he mishits a shot at the time when he never would mishit a shot. But still, he put himself there. And obviously a great victory for Molinari and the European Tour and this continent. So he showed signs. It just had to be right place at the right time. And you look at the numbers and the stats, not just what the scores he shot, but the efficiency, how well he did in strokes gained, fairways hit, putting. You know, it was not like he lucked this one out. You know, he played golf, winning golf, and he did it on a golf course that was set up like a major championship. I mean, I'm sure you saw it. You couldn't miss a fairway there, because if you did, it kind of sunk down the way we used to call it, old U.S. Open rough. Faraday said it, that you just should set up major championship courses like that, and you would probably have there wouldn't be as much controversy about it, and If it produced a Tiger Woods or a player of that scale, then you'd realize that was a fairer and a smarter way to do things.
It was this week last year at the President's Cup that Tiger spoke about possibly never playing the game again, and that he may have to just come to accept that. Now, maybe part of that was lowering expectations, knowing that a comeback was imminent. But you've tracked him for years, from U.S. amateurs to the 97 Masters to cruising at Pebble Beach. When you look at what he's been through over the last 3-4 years with the consistent back problems and just mentally what he's had to go through, where do you put the achievement of winning on Sunday night?
Well, he, as you said, a walking miracle, and I don't think he was saying that to sort of amp up the story. From a dramatic standpoint, I don't know enough about Hogan's car accident to speak to every detail, but if you get run over by a truck or a bus and you're that close to death, I'm not sure if we're ranking comebacks here, which is sort of subjective anyway, then where do you rank it? All I know is that he couldn't get out of bed, let alone swing a golf club. He was obviously had some other issues that have been documented that caused a lot of pain for him physically and for his life and for his family too. And so he's overcome a lot. And I remember talking to him at the Open Friday night going into the weekend, and about his family and his kids who were there, and about how much he wanted them to feel what it was like when their dad was close to winning a major championship. And Saturday into Sunday gave him a good feel of what it was like. And then, of course, he finally pushes it over, and not a major, but in one of the biggest golf tournaments of the year. And let's face it, I can't say this group of golfers is going to turn out like the Hall of Famers, like Ernie Els and Vijay Singh and Phil Mickelson, guys he beat the first time around. But skill-wise, this is a group that said they always wanted to get in there and see what it was like to compete and beat Tiger Woods. Well, it turned out that Rory can speak to that. Justin Rose, a little bit older. Rosie made the point when he won, when he won the FedEx Cup, that it was good for kind of an old guy to win with a wink in his eye. So I can't see him. Well, I don't want to say this wrong. I think it would be somewhat of a miracle if he wins four more major championships. Having said that, now he's got to 80, and he's only going to build on it. And I don't anticipate him training too hard to hurt his back. I think he's going to be. He's been smart about it, and that's why he is where he is right now, and coming off a win, and with everyone realizing, every one of his peers that want to take a shot at him, that this might be a lot harder than we thought it was going to be.
Yeah, that's interesting there that you talk about the previous era, the likes of Ernie Els and even Phil Mickelson being part of that, Hall of Famers, and whether this crop are equal, because this crop, in a way, had an open field to go through for quite a while when Tiger wasn't there, and some of them have racked up major wins quite quickly, which is something that was denied to Ernie and Phil for so long, whereas I think people generally look at this current crop as maybe been a step ahead of what was there 10, 15 years ago. You've seen both. The previous crop just suffered from the Tiger effect, obviously.
I don't think the previous crop choked. I think they were just overwhelmed by golf that no one had ever seen before. I mean, sure, there were a couple of times in there that somebody was intimidated because it was Tiger Woods. But for the most part, I think he just played golf at such a level that was higher above everyone else that's what created the records. That and this sheer will. And let's not forget that we're talking about this comeback. He won a U.S. Open with a broken leg. And some say he hadn't been right since, you know, that broken leg and that dragging him through that. There were some after effects of it that led to his back issue that ultimately took that fusion, the last chance fusion, for it to work for him. So you think about the elements of where he came back from a physical standpoint, a golfing standpoint, then all the other things that the demons that he was fighting. One of the things I thought was appropriate about it all was that people really weren't judging him. I mean, everybody's a human being, make mistakes. Not everybody in the spotlight he's in. And I think that's what kind of started to turn him around and make him become more appreciative, more accessible. Not like you can call him up and, you know, hey, Tiger, what's going on? But you know what I'm saying. He's got a softer edge to him now than he did before. And that, in the true spirit of the game, is what it's supposed to be about. And he's starting to show some of those signs. I mean, it's not like he's Arnold Palmer or Phil Mickelson, but, you know, he's starting to be, I guess, maybe he was a nice guy all along, but nobody knew about it, you know. And now he's showing signs of being a nice guy.
And that's probably quite relevant for this week as well, because a lot of people out there, certainly our listeners, will have read the biography of Tiger Woods that was out recently, and probably would have been somewhat surprised by, at a very personal level, how cold Tiger could be, and downright rude at times. We all knew that he was the ultimate focus on winning golf tournaments to those around him, but just in general everyday life, that he'd be quite rude to people. And coming into Ryder Cups and his general relationship with the Ryder Cup and where he was 10 years ago to where he is now, do you see a very different Tiger Woods and his role within the team room? Is there a genuine warmth there towards his teammates?
I think you just look at, and part of his his comeback, Justin Thomas was talking about it today, all those kids down in Jupiter, that's why they became close, because they believed in him, and they would go and hang out with him and when he was only being able to chip and putt. And that was, I think that showed him something too. And, you know, that was part of being more appreciative and being, you know, the man he is now versus the person he was a couple of years ago when he was fighting all sorts of things. And most of them we'll never know about. Some of them may leak out over the course of time, but I think we get a general picture of what it was like.
Yeah, it's not all about Tiger this week, but we were getting very excited earlier in the week when it looked like there might be the possibility of Tiger and Phil leading out this American team in the Friday four balls. Now Jim Furyk seems to have poured a little bit of cold water on that, and maybe it would be Tiger and Patrick Reed, Phil, Bryson DeChambeau. What's your sense from watching this American team come together as to what the pairings will be and what Jim Furyk's thinking is?
I think he's got enough options now where There's different philosophies about putting Woods and Mickelson together. As you know, they're playing for $10 million pretty soon anyway, but that's not a Ryder Cup where there's no money on the line. They're playing as teammates. They're not playing against each other. I think the chemistry is right now. I think it sets up a potential controversy if it doesn't work. And, you know, why would you have to go through that? Unless they both ask for it, I think Jim would listen seriously. I'm sure they've talked about it, and but I'm not sure if it's the right thing to do, because I think there's too many other good combinations for him to use. There's a lot of great players on that team. Furyk would never do this because he's smart enough not to. You know, Hogan introduced his team one time as the 12 best players in the world. I was there when Floyd introduced his team at the Belfry as 12 best players in the world, and that didn't work out too well because Europe can band together like no other franchise in sports, quite honestly. And so I guess I'm kind of giving you the full dodge on this, because partially because I haven't dug down to really give a stronger definitive answer, but I just think there's not as much upside to it as some people think.
Yeah, the fallout might be just a little bit too much come lunchtime on Friday if Tiger and Phil go first out and end up losing, and it ends up overshadowing the entire day.
I will say, if you don't mind, I mean, this is not like a fake friendship. I mean, they have become to a point where, and Mickelson was one of the guys that reached out early too. And it was an old story, I never confirmed this, but I believe it was true. It was like Butch and Tiger were on an elevator and the door opened and Mickelson got in and the door closed and they went up or down and no words were said, you know, and the elevator door opened and Mickelson walked out. This is like early on, way early on. And it was part of his way of trying to get in Phil's head. You know, that was the way he was. And they're two different guys now, and they've come to appreciate each other and have a good time together. And I don't think, you know, I don't know, a football coach, you can't fake emotion, you know, and true emotion. And I think they're at a point now where they are friends. And through many President's Cup experiences, you know, who gets credit for this? Going back to in President's Cup history, it was Jack Nicklaus that actually encouraged them to get out the ping pong table and start getting to know each other a little bit better. And, of course, Jack had similar type of relationship with Arnold Palmer early in his days, so he could sort of speak to that. And that started this mending process that we're seeing come to full form here. It would be nice, even if it was a blowout, you know, I don't think it's worth the risk, to tell you the truth. It feels too good right now.
It'll be a heck of an atmosphere up in that first tee with 7,000 people there if Tiger and Phil stroll on bright and early on Friday morning. So Jim Furyk, as you say, he's way too smart to come out and say this is the strongest American team or the best American team, but statistically it is the strongest American team. When you look at the potential lineups there, Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth are longtime friends, Dustin Johnson and Ricky Fowler, again today with Brooks Koepka and Tony Finau, and Bubba Watson and Webb Simpson know each other well from Glen Eagles. It is absolutely stacked. Do you see any way this American team don't win this Ryder Cup?
Oh, sure. I mean, I've been to every Ryder Cup since 1983, except for one. I missed in 85, so this is 17 for me. So I get the energy. You know, I understand it. I was there when you know, Lanny Watkins hits that shot and there's a bolt of lightning and Nicklaus kisses the divot. And that was just the beginning of the Big Five. And then I've been through all of these eras. And I've learned to appreciate the spirit of European golf and what it stands for, and kind of the chip on the shoulder. And it used to get kind of ugly, to tell you the truth. I think it's much more, you know, on a sportsmanship level. But there's still this passion, and I love it. I love the sound. I love the way European fans embrace the event. And now American players have, and not American players, I think, well, yeah, American players are more all in than they used to be. And quite honestly, the fans are too. I mean, all you have to do is go to one Ryder Cup, whether it's in the U.S. or in Europe, to feel this incredible feeling of flow that this European team has, and how it dictates, you know, a result sometimes in this competition more than the actual golf does itself.
Tim, that's brilliant. Thanks a lot for taking the time out to talk to us and Off the Ball, and enjoy the week.
Thanks, Nathan. We got anything on this for like the results?
You want €5?
€5 or just bragging rights, whatever.
€5, and we'll exchange money at Royal Port Rush next year.
Done deal. Anytime you're in Jupiter, golf's on me, Nathan.
Anytime. It's nailed on.
Bad idea getting involved in bets with Nathan Murphy, but there you go. That is Nathan, and all of our Ryder Cup coverage is brought to you in association with Now TV. Only pay for the days you want and stream all 10 Sky Sports channels with the Now TV Sky Sports Pass. We'll have loads more from Nathan and Joe tomorrow night, and indeed right across Ryder Cup weekend. from Paris at Le Golf National, with action getting underway in and of itself on Friday. Action in the Carabao Cup is already underway, 2 minutes into the 7:45 kickoffs tonight, Kev. We're just seeing Liverpool and Chelsea making their way out. The teams are already out and underway in that one, 3 minutes played. Great scenes and fairly decent, strong sides from both.
Yeah, tonight. It should be a decent game. I think it certainly gives us a bit of a feel for the weekend, doesn't it, with the two ties meeting.
Are you surprised that the sides are as strong given they're playing against on Saturday?
It's something I spoke about before. I expected Liverpool to make the amount of changes they've made. I thought they'd make play a total different back four, lads that need a game as well. It will be much changed from their point of view for the weekend. But for Chelsea, there's probably one or two in that side that I'm surprised they're actually playing. But it makes it certainly competitive, and it just goes to show the strength on the two squads.
Come here to me. We have to talk about this Mourinho and Pogba video. We'll get to it a little bit later on with Phil McNulty, because this video came out today, for those who haven't seen it, of Pogba making his way onto the Carrington training pitch, greeted by Jose Mourinho. They exchange words and some frosty, frosty looks. And in the extended version, it seems as if he's asked to explain his actions, resulting around a Instagram post from last night during the 2-2 draw with Derby, which they ultimately lost. He's asked to why me alone, Sean Pereira, were around me too. It's not only you that walked out, blah, 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 and on we go. But this is the latest and new low in that relationship. It's going to be one or the other that goes from this point on, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems that way. You can tell, certainly with that reaction there today, you can tell. I mean, you've seen little things happen and they fester away on the training ground. It gets to this sort of stage and it goes one step further. It does look like it's either him or Pogba, as in him, and or Mourinho. It does look like that. Now, that's the stage it's getting to, isn't it? Which do the club see as the way forward? Are they going to keep Pogba with his marketing value, what he means to the club, certainly financially, and everything that they've vested in him, or the amount they've probably invested in him? And I think, or do they think, well, no, Mourinho's a man. It's a tricky one now for the club going forward, I think.
It is a delicate one, because no one's saying that Jose Mourinho is in the ideal position as a Manchester United manager at the moment, but you can't be seen as a club to sack a manager and keep a player who is so obviously causing ructions.
Totally, that's exactly the point.
Because then whoever comes in after that is starting on the back foot.
Yeah, that most definitely. It is it is sending out the wrong message, you say, from the top, that the old adage, no one's bigger than the club, but it certainly puts out a strong message. I think if they were to, then they were going to back the player in this one. So from reading between the lines, it looks like they are going to be backing Mourinho going forward. Will they accept any sort of offer for him come the January transfer window? Clearly it's got to the stage where Pogba doesn't enjoy playing the style of football that Mourinho plays, and he feels as though he's been stifled.
One of the questions, we'll get to this a little bit later, I guess, in the football show too, but very quickly, Barcelona is the club that's been named most prominently in around Pogba's name. Jamie Carragher on Sky before tonight's game at Anfield saying that he couldn't think of a club less suited to Paul Pogba than Barcelona.
He's a Real Madrid player, isn't he? That's what you'd see him as, a Real Madrid. That's the way I'd certainly see him anyway. The type of player that he is, he could play with a bit more freedom, I suppose, there as well. And the stature that he'd bring to it going into that sort of environment. That's the way it would seem to me, but they do have a bit of money still available to the Barcelona. Would they be prepared to go and get him? They've just signed Vidal. Obviously, Coutinho's been fully integrated into Champions League football this season there as well. Rakitic in there. It'd be difficult, really, for them to go and sign him and fit him into that side, I'd feel.
Arsenal have just taken the lead at home to Brentford through Danny Welbeck. More to come after these.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.